Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's political commentary.
Morena Jennifer, Professor Jennifer Curtin, how are you this morning?
I'm good, thank you.
Did you get up nice and early to watch the inauguration, or were you...
No, I did. I'm such a nerd, honestly.
I love it.
So, yeah, and I watched it on the Al Jazeera. It was free to air, and it was... You know, the last time I got up and watched an inauguration, well, I was actually in the Northern Hemisphere and I watched Obama's first inauguration, and because I felt like that was a really important moment of change, right, in 2009. And so I haven't done any since, but this one, in a more subdued way, felt equally as important. And I have to say, Kamala Harris, you know, being sworn in, was as important and as moving a moment, as was the whole thing, really, because the number of, like, the diversity that was there that reflected America in terms of who sang, who gave the prayers, the poet laureate.
That was amazing.
Wasn't it?
The poet laureate was very special.
Very reassuring, I think, and not, you know, I suppose most Americans will find it uplifting. I think from the outside it was more like breathing a sigh of relief.
Absolutely. It was like the world did a big kind of exhale.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
speaking of speeches, somebody else did a speech recently, a 20-minute long final speech. Lots of choice quotes in it. As you would expect at the end of a term, I am, of course, talking about President Trump. It's a bit of a brag book, all the things he says he's very proud that he and his people did for America. And a lot of outlets and journalists have kind of done a bit of a fact check on it, and it doesn't all really stand up as being truthful. Did you manage to get through the full 20 minutes of President Trump's final speech?
Yeah, I have to say I didn't get up for this one. And didn't watch it. I just read the transcript, actually. And the first thing is, as someone who's interested in political rhetoric, the transcript shows that actually a lot of the way in which he delivers his speeches don't make sense. There's not a lot of full sentences
that's
in there.
True,
he loves the word incredible.
He does.
And I suppose the finish was a bit, you know, reminds us that he's thinking beyond us. So he just said, just a goodbye, we love you, and we'll be back in some form.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, rather ominous. But, yeah, the fact-checking on this has been really solid. So claiming that they did the vaccine in 9 months when the US government sort of gave some development money for one, but this has been a global pharma effort rather than a, you know, and the same, you know, he claimed that he passed the Veterans Affairs Choice Program. Obama did that, right? You know, the largest package of tax cuts and reforms, his tax cut size ranks 12th and was really skewed towards super wealthy Americans. And actually, one of the things that Biden has said he's going to rescind as soon as he gets into office. You know, but the sort of similar things around the growing the manufacturing base, claiming that he'd never tolerate political violence, all the things that we would expect from him, which were really just furphies or exaggerations.
There was also an interesting connection he seemed to try and make towards the end, saying at the very core of being an American citizen, there is the notion of free speech, which the way it was phrased very much seemed like a nod to his personal social media ban and big tech kind of saying to QAnon sentiment, we're not going to put up with you on our platforms anymore, to try and then associate that with being a true American. I thought, well, you're a bit too close to that one, Sunshine. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I think, and the other thing that he did was talk about, like, he offered luck and prayers and so on to Biden and his team.
Yes.
And that he says they'll do really well because they have a spectacular foundation from which to work. So, you know, implying that his last 4 years have really set Biden up to do the most amazing work.
Well, they've certainly set Biden up in a certain way. All my notes in front of me are calling him president-elect, but he's not anymore. He's officially the president after this morning. What does lie ahead for him? What is he going to inherit?
Well, I think it's more about his to-do list, and it's big, and some of it's going to have to be really fast. I think he'll be relieved that it looks like he has control of Congress. I mean, he does, but the party discipline in the US is much more lax than anything we'd see in New Zealand. So we have Democrats and Republicans crossing over from time to time. But certainly the coronavirus pandemic relief, you know, range of things that he's planning to use executive orders to sort around social distancing and the wearing of masks, and also rolling out 100 million vaccine doses in 100 days.
Wow.
That's his plan in his first 100 days of office. And it might mean that some of the second dose jabs might not be able to happen, and put some more PPE equipment out there and do more testing. So he sees the virus. I mean, in his speech, I don't know if you noticed, he talked about, I hadn't realised, that the number of deaths in the US from the coronavirus is now at the level or surpassed the number of deaths of American soldiers during World War II.
Yeah, isn't that phenomenal?
It's just insane, right? So that's his priority. He's going to rejoin WHO, the World Health Organization, and he's got a bunch of economic measures to support the most poor, like renters and homeowners who are struggling, student loan repayments.
Those facing eviction due to COVID-19.
Yeah, those sorts of things. And then he's going to end those tax cuts. And then climate change is back on the agenda for him, so getting back into the Paris Agreement. But he's also got some quite specific domestic things he'd like to do or wants to do, like cancelling that oil sands pipeline that comes through from Alberta through Montana.
Right.
And getting some emissions limits on cars and, you know, trying to deal with methane pollution in terms of oil and gas operations. But some of this is going to be really hard because America is federal, so he's dependent on state governors and so on. But, you know, it's a really strong aspirational agenda that he's looking to use executive orders to and actions to get stuff through. Also around, like, reunification of families, those children that Trump just separated from their families, getting them back together, and stopping that immigration or travel ban on the Muslim countries plus the extras that Trump added over the course of his tenure.
There's a lot of things to try and row back in a very short amount of time. How many of those things will end up on the House floor going to a vote?
Oh, you'd probably have to ask an American politics specialist that, because I know that he can use executive orders on something.
Right, I guess that's what I'm getting at. So is an executive order a way of trying to try and enact change very quickly?
Yeah, totally.
Now, we have seen a lot of a certain name in the New Zealand press recently who has been a Trump staffer, Mr. Chris Liddell. He was a candidate for the OECD Secretary General. Recently, the National Party and the ACT Party rescinded their kind of support for him being a candidate for this role. Why is this contentious? Why was it taking up so many column inches over here?
Well, Chris Liddell's pretty famous in business corporate circles within New Zealand anyway. When Obama was re-elected, he was finishing up, I think, his job with General Motors, or maybe he was still there then. He's been a chief financial officer of some quite big international companies, you know, and Q&A were in Washington at the time, and he came on a panel. I met him there because I was on the panel as well, you know, talking about what Obama's second term would bring. So he clearly had an interest in American politics as well as the American economy and business and so on. And you know, I suppose that's the thing we latch on to in New Zealand when our superstars go overseas and be superstars over there as well.
Right.
And this is the left and the right. This isn't just so he's already pretty famous. He'd been given one of those awards that John Key gives out and the Prime Minister gives out at different times. But Trump put his name, so he was nominated for the OECD Secretary General job as a candidate by Trump, not
right.
by New Zealand.
Right.
And then what he wanted to do was try and shore up New Zealand support. And what we know about the OECD is that it's sort of shifted. It used to be sort of this bastion of neoliberal economic doctrine, and some might still see it like that, but it has, under Jose Gurría, it has shifted and become thought to become more inclusive in the way that it thinks about economic and public finance policy. But, you know, Trump was threatening to pull money out of the OECD because it is supported by 37 member countries that are reasonably well off. And as the World Health Organization knows, they don't want to lose, you know, these rich countries from supporting their enterprise as an international organization. So there were rumors that an American nominee might have to get this role to appease the US to keep them in there. I think with the fact that Chris Liddell didn't leave office when the Capitol riots happened, demonstrated no sort of real remorse about what the Trump legacy would be, really started to damage his reputation more generally, and it was clear that he was unlikely to get the role, so he's allegedly withdrawn now.
Yes, allegedly has. So what was his role within Trump's staff?
So he was the deputy chief of staff, and he was also the assistant to the president for strategic initiatives. So that's why he was sort of allegedly involved, which he denies, in the vote to separate children from their families when
wow.
they were coming over, because that was one of Trump's strategic initiatives. I think that his claim to fame, at least on Wikipedia, is that he's the only non-family senior member of the Trump staff to last the full
four years.
I'm not sure that's like a claim to fame right now, right?
But it's certainly an interesting fact.
Yeah, totally.
Either by blood or by marriage, I'm assuming.
So he's got some work to do, I think. Apparently he wants to return to New Zealand, so he might have to go quiet for a year or so, and then he'll probably, you know, have redeemed himself in some way and get another really cool, high-paying job for some international organisation.
Oh, lovely. As always, seems to be the way. Thank you so much. We've covered a huge amount of very American ground this morning. Professor Jennifer Curtin, Professor of Politics and Director of the Public Policy Institute at University of Auckland, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Sarah.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.